John Sargent is an American book publisher, most recently CEO of Macmillan USA and executive vice president of Holzbrinck, in charge of global publishing and Macmillan Learning. He joined the company in 1996. He's known for his role in disagreeing with Amazon.
Yes.
Over agency pricing and his response. Now he's known for more than this. And his response to Donald Trump's cease and desist attempt to block Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury. In 2017, PEN America honored him for his commitment to the protection of publishers, authors, and intellectual property throughout his long and distinguished career in publishing. Welcome, John, to the Bibliophile.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Nigel.
Took me a bit, though. Okay, so I want to just start in Wyoming. Your parents divorced in 65?
Yeah, that's right. When I can't remember when the divorce is. They separated earlier than that. In that area. Yeah.
So how did that feel?
Don't have a lot of real memories of anger or bitterness about it at all. Just don't, you know, I was young when they separated. I was probably, I don't know, six or something like that. So, it's not a big part of my memory. The feelings there are not a part of my memory.
Okay. And then you, grew up and you went to Yale.
No. No, I moved to Wyoming when I was eight, and I went my undergraduate degree at Stanford.
I got the wrong page here.
And then I went to Columbia Business School.
Yes, okay. And then you left university. Did you decide at that point that because your grandfather had been such an amazing publisher that you wanted to follow in his footsteps?
No, I had wanted to be a marine biologist. And then upon graduation, it was not easy to get a job. And I bombed out on a whole bunch of interviews. Stanford offered a publishing course. And so I was unemployed. And I decided, well, let me try publishing. We got my dad was a publisher. At that point, was still a publisher, family business, all that stuff. So I said, well, let me take a look at it. It had always been sort of, you know, as a possibility. So I took the publishing course, and they had a placement center at the publishing course, and I got a job as a sales rep selling college textbooks. And it was the first job I was offered, so I took it, moved to Seattle, Washington.
Okay. Can you tell me exactly what you did for that job and how you were evaluated?
Sure. I was a college traveler, so I covered the territory between the Canadian border, Northern California, and all the way east to the Rocky Mountains. So sort of think Southern Colorado up to north of the border, north of Seattle, that whole territory. So I went to all the junior colleges, major universities, sold college textbooks on the road. The common loop was three. I'd leave home and I'd get back 3 months later, sort of different hotel room every two or three nights. I was a straight up traveling salesman is what I guess is the definition of it.
Okay. And why did you succeed at that?
I don't know. I'm a reasonably personal guy, and I worked hard, right? I went to more schools than anybody else. I was averaging 20 cold calls a day with professors.
20 so many, a day? No, that's an exaggeration.
No, that was the target, and I was going to hit the goddamn target, you know? Well, there were days that I'd get, you know, 11 or 12, but there's days that I get 24, 25. Now, that includes stopping a guy in the hallway and saying, are you teaching Anthropology 101 next year? He says no. I say, okay, that's a call, right?
That counts. Yeah, I mean, you were, what, wait a sec. You were paid per call? Is that how it worked?
No, I was paid a salary, and I got a bonus if I hit sales numbers. So it's standard sales job.
Okay.
But the expectation was that you do this. But I traveled more than anybody else in the country by far.
Okay.
And I was probably difficult to manage in that I like to do things my own way and the like. But there was no doubt that I worked hard, and the numbers came in pretty good. And so, you know, I got promoted at the end of the year to be a field manager and all that stuff. So it was a good job.
Okay. So what was it about your sales pitch that was so good?
After the first year, I got a new manager and he came out to work with me, and he wanted me to use the sort of Xerox method of selling. You know, he said, you got to go in here and you stick your hand out and you say, hi, my name's John Sargent. I'm with D. Van Nostrand. And then you do this. After you worked with me for a day, I called the vice president of sales. I said, well, look, I'm happy to still work for you, Steve, but if I have to work for this guy, I'm out. And he said, okay. And so I ended up working straight for him. And basically I just, you know, I'd go in and introduce myself in whatever way I thought would work with the individual and the person by how I judge them. Typical sales stuff, right? I was a reasonably good sales guy.
Yeah, I got a story for you. My first job was as a sales rep for More Business Forms.
Okay.
And I had a territory in rural Saskatchewan. I had Saskatoon, a chunk of Saskatoon and rural Saskatchewan. And I had to drive around selling business forms to farm implement dealers. So first time I went out, I was wearing a suit.
Uh-huh.
I went into a farm implement dealer with a bunch of guys sitting around, you know, in their jeans and such. And I came in and I said, and I'm with More Business Forms. I'm with More Business Forms. And the joke was, of course, no, we don't want any more business forms. And I left and I never wore a suit again. So, but the reason I mentioned that out in the prairies, anyway, out on the, you know, on the prairies, the reason I mentioned that is that it's all about, you know, mirroring your client.
Yeah. No, it's understanding who you're talking to, right?
Right.
And putting yourself in their shoes, not looking at it through your eyes. Ask them enough questions to understand what they want and what they need, and then take whatever you're selling and try to figure out how to get them to say yes.
Okay. Okay, so you went from there to what? The field manager? Is that it?
Yeah, and then that was for a year, and then I went to Columbia Business School.
Right. And what'd you learn there? What was the most important thing that you learned there?
I was going to do marketing, and I thought it didn't make sense for publishing for what I knew. And so, you know, because they teach, it's basically product marketing, right? Products. And that's not what publishing is. I ended up taking finance and accounting. And the thing I learned was enough finance and accounting to understand in some level of detail, complex balance sheets and P&Ls, debits and credits. And I learned enough that I could understand if somebody was trying to put one over on me in the financial sector, right? So I learned enough so that when the tax guys come in and say, listen, this is a deferred asset and I could say, are you sure? Because, and I would know just enough to sort of push them and understand. They knew that I understood enough that they couldn't say, oh, this is a publishing guy. He doesn't need to know this stuff, right? So I had just enough knowledge from business school that was useful for that. And it got me a job. It got me a job in corporate finance.
And where was that?
Doubleday.
A Fendi's company.
Yes. Yes. The old boys company. And that president at that time run by my father.
Okay. Okay. So you were protecting management from these financial types that you thought were BSing you?
No, it was, we'll put it this way. If you're going to talk to an editor, it's pretty useful to have read a whole bunch of books, right?
Yes.
And if you're going to talk to a finance guy, it's pretty useful to understand a balance sheet.
Right. Yeah. Well, look, I'm going to quote Effendi right now. Okay.
Okay.
Well, actually, this is Christopher Morley who did afterward. And he says that Effendi was really the first of a new era in book publishing, which he visualized foremost as a business, not merely as a dignified literary avocation. So,
yeah, his son after that famously didn't pay much attention to the literary piece at all. His son was a pure businessman.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
You wanted to come back and balance it back up?
No, I didn't have any of that sort of historical family, you know, perspective stuff going on. I had majored in economics and I was always pretty good with numbers and science and stuff like that. And business interested me. Selling is business, right? It's at the end of the day, it's a business thing. And I'd figured out, you know, in selling, I'd figured out that they were going to evaluate me by how much I brought in versus how much I cost them. So I worked hard at both ends, right? So I never stayed in any place nicer than a Motel 6 in all my travels. I had this huge territory, but I had the lowest expenses of anybody. So I had already figured out that, you know, that's how they're going to do what makes sense for them financially. It's all going to be what I cost them versus what I brought in the door. I always lean that way, and that's why business school was interesting to me. But I also always, in college, I took, you know, extensive amounts of literature courses and English because I always loved to read. And I had a love for books from very early on. I was unlike most young boys at the time, and that I really did like to read.
So you made everyone happy.
Well, I don't know about that.
You're doing the literary side and you're doing the business. Yeah. You're saving money and you're making money. So
So I have from the get-go, I had the ability to talk books with the editors and cash and accounting with the banks that we were borrowing money from.
Okay. Did you, like your grandfather, dream night and day of a list which would be the greatest ever put together?
No, I never had list ambitions as much as I had book ambitions, right? So I wanted to run a great company that published fantastic books, but I was interested in the books, not the, the list and all that, but it was more about, you know, I wanted to publish books that mattered. And when I say mattered, it didn't have to be great literature. It had to be that were good at what they did. So if it was a commercial book, be a great commercial book. If it was a literary book, be a great literary book. But I didn't have a particular literary bent. I could go either way on that. Appreciated both for what they were, respected both for what they were, and always knew it was about making money as well. To get anywhere, you got to make money. You could select the highest quality literature all day long, but if you couldn't sell it, it was a problem. So I never had that sort of, I need to build a list that fit together, that blended this and that and covered every aspect of publishing. I never had that. I had more, geez, God, that sounds like a great book. I'd love to publish that and make sure that every book not every book, but the majority of the books we bought, we had a way to make money with them, right? Because it's a business.
Yeah, so you want to make the money early on, but the definition of a great list is to have a bunch of great books on it because they'll have legs.
Yeah.
They'll, you know, if they're classics, they're going to be bought 50 years from now.
Early on, when you're a publisher, you get asked, you know, a fair amount. You get asked, you know, what's the book you're proudest of ever publishing and all that. So on, I developed a sort of framework in my mind for what would be the books I was proudest of. When I would find those books, it would be fantastic for me, you know. Part of being proud of a book is you have to work on it, right? You can't be proud of a book just because you're a corporate executive and it happens to be published in the company you're responsible for. You have to actually work on the book if it is to be something that you can take pride in.
You personally, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by that, though?
Well, one of the unique and fabulous things about publishing is no matter where you are in the organization, you can work on a book. Right. So I can at any point in time running Macmillan, if I found a book I thought was important, I could use my relationships and my power in the organization to make that book become a focus of energy and excitement. And I still sold books, you know, I sold individual titles all the way to the end. I was calling, I was on the chairlift. I was on the chairlift yesterday, still selling Being Immortal by Atul Gawande. I sold 3 copies on the chairlift yesterday.
And what? You're not even going to get paid for that, are you?
I'm not getting paid, but I get a great sense. Yeah. Everybody who buys that, I have to tell you, everybody who reads that book, they get something valuable out of it. I get pleasure. And so I keep selling it. I don't get any compensation, but I'll be selling that book the day I die.
Okay, what's the name of that book again?
Being Mortal.
Okay.
It's by Atul Gawande, and it's about, he's a doctor, he writes for the New Yorker, and it's about how doctors are trained to fix you no matter what. And at the end of life, maybe fixing you is not the right answer, right? And doctors just are not, surgeons in particular, are trained to take any measure to keep you alive. And you know what? Is that the right answer? And the only way you get that physician to make sure you're in the same spot with that physician at the end of your life is if you ask him the questions and if he asks the questions, right? So you have stomach cancer, you're getting opened up. He can do one of two things. He can try to fix you. You go through hideous pain and all this stuff and you end up being a shell. Or he can just close you back up and say, that was too much. And then you die in, 3 months and a lot more comfort. He has to know what you want when he opens you up. That's your decision, not his. And this is the point of the book. Anyways, very powerful book. I highly recommend it.
I don't know. It doesn't sound that interesting to me. You got to work harder. Work harder.
If I was on my game, I would already been talking to you about your brother because you brought that up. And I would have said, how's your parents? And I would have gotten to what your concerns were first, and then I would have brought the book, which is what I did on the chair left.
Okay. But you know what you're getting at right there? You're getting to the essence of what publishing, or certainly selling books, is all about, and that is the enthusiastic endorsement of something by a friend or someone who you respect. That's what you want.
If you look at how many books are published on how many topics in the world, everybody needs somebody to, on a regular basis, cut away the chaff and say, okay, you don't need this, this, this. Here's the book you need to read. And that is one of the things I enjoyed hugely my entire career, right? Was helping people on that, okay, you like to read thrillers. Who do you like to read? You like to read this guy. You like to read that woman. Okay. How about this person? If you like them, how about this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you're doing is you're doing them a good turn. You're trying to make their life better, right?
Yeah. Exactly right. That's the great satisfaction in publishing a good book is you're delivering its entertainment. It might be knowledge. It might be enrichment. But you are delivering for people something of value.
Yeah, it's altruism, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah. At least for me, that was the great reward. It wasn't the paycheck, right? It was you could work all day long doing this spectacular thing. It was cool. It was a fun a thing that gave you, I did it outside of work, right? And people would ask, when you're publishing, what should I read? Was always the first question. And it was always a great pleasure to sort of help them.
Well, again, as I say, you want to help them have a more interesting, happier life.
I used to sell everybody's books too, not only ours.
Anything that's good. Yeah. Okay, I don't know if this is embellishing this is Christopher Morley again at the end of Effendi's book. Makes you love this guy, okay? Because here's what Christopher says. He says, years ago, before the name of Joseph Conrad was known to more than a few critics, he was contributing a monthly stipend to keep Conrad writing.
Yeah.
And this long before any of Conrad's books were under his own imprint. That is pretty damn good.
So Effendi was my great grandfather. His son was my grandfather, and his son published Somerset Maugham. When the war happened, Maugham was Jewish and living in France. He got him out of there and renovated a cabin on a river in his place in South Carolina, gave him a house and a writing room, and he wrote Razor's Edge living with his publisher, on his publisher's, 100% on his publisher's dime. You know, it's a fantastic thing, you know. Those days are gone, but both those guys really cared and believed in the authors.
Well, that's good in the sense that it brings me to my next question here, which is publishers up until what, like the 70s, 80s? I mean, they were focusing on everything to do with books. There's a story that Peter Mayer, publishing executive,
his father was also a publisher. Overlook Press was started by his father.
Okay. He saw the potential in Frederick Warren. Anyway, he saw Beatrice's
father,
her stuff in that list, and he bought that company.
Yeah.
And then they started making all sorts of all sorts of stuff, right? So publishing started to become way more than just books. But then agents started coming in.
Yeah, Beatrix Potter was one of the early executions of merchandising and commercial rights.
Right.
That has existed and sometimes owned by the publisher and sometimes not, right?
But that's what I'm saying. It seems to me that publishing was primarily about books. Then we started getting into merchandising, but we also then get agents coming in saying, wait a minute, publishers shouldn't be doing that. Publishers should be sticking to books. We need to take care of all this merchandising and make sure the authors compensated for it.
I think the authors always were compensated for it. When the merchandise rights were sold, they got royalties just like they did for books. So I disagree with you a little bit that was a key turning point. I think what happened is agents became increasingly powerful as authors realized, as publishers were more and more about business and making money, that authors needed someone on their side of the battle. Authors not being in their nature necessarily business people, right? And so they did something to counterbalance the power of the publisher as it became more and more business. And agents filled that gap. And at the same point, it made publishers, in a lot of ways, it made it a more hands-off, less personal relationship.
Exactly.
Which in some ways was quite useful, right? You didn't have to read that incredible slush pile because the agents read the incredible slush pile.
That's part of it. But the other thing that's interesting is that in a way, it's like you're not a couple of musketeers together anymore. It's not we're winning all this stuff together. It's like we're doing the book part, but we're not actually even going to talk about or celebrate all the other stuff, because that's being peeled off for the age.
No, I think I disagree with you 100% on that, really. It is a partnership thing. Look, at the end of the day, if you look at particularly commercial fiction now, right? Think how much money is made when a movie is made or a TV series is made, right?
That's where the real money is,
Yeah, so but for the publisher, that's where the real money is too, right?
Because they sell a whole bunch more books as a result.
Well, we did Silence of the Lambs was published at St. Martin's before I got there. But that book exploded with the movie.
Right.
It was a good-sized book, but it wasn't a huge book. But when the movie, there was 4 million copies sold of the movie Pioneer Edition. There's a symbiotic thing where the publisher encourages the author, wants the author to succeed in selling the movie rights, and wants to cooperate, right? So there's
the tie-in
edition needs to have the movie poster art, and we as publishers desperately wanted the movie to be a big hit, right? So we were highly enthusiastic if the agent got so-and-so to be the director. You know, this is all great news for us. So it wasn't a contentious thing. It was more hoping, you know, would it have been nice to get a slice of the royalty right? Sure. But at the end of the day, the authors won that one, and fair enough, I think. Fair enough.
Okay. I guess what I'm thinking, though, is that if it weren't for agents, publishers would be making a shitload more money because they used to negotiate the movie rights.
It's not that as much as it's the unearned advance, right? What the agents are really good at is maximizing the dollar advance you pay the author.
The big thing there was Andrew Wiley getting $1 million for Martin Amis.
So what happened is it all became about the author advance, and the agents got a lot more money in advance for the authors, which was a direct hit to all the publishers' P&Ls, right? We didn't used to have the unearned advance write-off. And now it's one of the single largest elements of the publishing P&L is the advance write-off. That was the great effect of agents. There wasn't so much money in the movie rights and in the merchandise rights that we were sharing. The movement from the publishing P&L to the author's P&L, the biggest movement was the huge spike in advances. That's where the most money went from the publishers to the
author. Right, but it's not even, it's just a shifting of risk. You know, after a couple of years, you get all your money back. Well, then it's no big deal.
Exactly right. People used to ask me why I never went to Las Vegas. I didn't like to gamble. I didn't put any money on sports. I said, I gamble all day, every day at work.
Yes, you do, of course. Well, I mean, that's why you try to hire people who know how to risk management. You know, you want to hire someone who's going to pick a book that you're not going to, even if you lay out $1 million or whatever it is, you know you're going to get your money back.
The thing there is that's an instinctual call. And even in all these days of quantitative analysis and artificial intelligence and all that shit, at the end of the day, it is still a human being reading that book. This one, if we change it this way and this way, this one's going to work. And that's an intuitive exercise, not a quantitative analysis.
No, wait a sec. I disagree.
Okay.
I think that a really good editor is going to go in and say, yeah, if you fix this up and this up, then it's going to be a great book. That's not intuitive.
Sure it is. How do they know that?
Because they know what great work is. They're playing around with the sentences and they're making the book great.
What do you plug into your computer to give you that answer?
That I'm going to move this sentence up and it's going to make it way better? You don't plug that into a computer, but you just know good writing when you see it.
That's it. You know good writing when you see it.
Right.
You know a good story when you hear it, because intuitively, through your years of experience, you have gained enough knowledge and information in your head that you say, yes, this one works, and no, that one won't. Right?
Okay.
And that's not something you can plug into a computer. You can't use an algebraic formula. No. That is years and years of experience and your intellectual self.
No. I think if I'm reading something and I think it's really good, I don't think that's intuition.
What intuition or intuitive work is you take all of the worldly experience you have and you apply it, and you feel that this is going to be right or this is going to be wrong.
It's not a feeling. It's not a feeling. You make the change, you read it, and you say, that's way better than that. That's not a feeling.
So let's not talk about the editorial process of making it better. Let's talk about getting a manuscript, reading it, and understanding, is this a great book
or not?
Or is this a great book, but it will only be a great book if the author makes these changes? That's the thing. That's your personal reaction to the book.
Yeah.
And it's informed by your years and years of experience. And that's why no computer at this stage, no computer can do that.
It's formed by good taste. I don't know if you need years and years of experience to get good taste or not. I don't know.
Sometimes I agree. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But what I can tell you is if you have good taste and years of experience, It's better than just having good taste.
Okay. I'll concede that. Okay. So we were in Wyoming and you went to Stanford. You didn't go to Yale.
No, I didn't go to Yale.
Right. Let's look at, have we gone through the different roles that you've played? That's what I want to get at is, you know, you're good. You got to the top. How did you do that? And specifically, what did you do doing that? Maybe you just...
Yeah. I always believed in hard work, right? And in learning a lot. I got very high in the, call it in the publishing organization, very young. By the time I was 29, I was a division president. That was a combination of hard work and skill and luck and people who helped me, right? Along the way.
What skills?
I had a combination of a love of the book, writing, and business skills, right? So that was
it's an interesting combination.
Yeah, that's not a normal combination. And what I did is I realized very early that publishing is interesting, right? Because it's a highly complex business. You can always do more work. It's infinite the amount of work you can do on any single book, right? Think about it.
Right.
You can spend hours and hours of every day on every single book trying to sell more copies one way or another. And you have these massive lists coming through. So what I realized right away is you could do more work and be useful to the organization in many ways. So in my early jobs, what I did is I went to editors. I was working in the business office. I went to editors and I said, look, you know, I know you need readers on your book. I'm happy to read manuscripts. So they would give me manuscripts and I'd give them back like book reports. You know, nice. I'd do it on my own time. I'd do it at night. And then, you know, I remember I was at Doubleday and we had bookstores. Doubleday.
They owned bookstores. That's right.
Largest chain in America at the time. And I went to the head of that and I said, you know, I was in charge of pricing our books, our front list. And I went to the guy and I said, you know, I'm making these decisions. I got no knowledge about how the consumer actually decides. So at night, I would go, I said, I'll do it for free.
You'd stalk the consumer.
I did. I went and I worked in the bookshop. I said, I'll do anything you tell me to do in the bookstore. Right. And I'll give you 3 hours a night. I'll do anything you want me to do. My first great lesson, my first night, I show up. He puts me down in the basement. He's ordered four copies of a Bantam book. And instead of four copies, it was mass market. Instead of getting four copies, they sent him four displays, 96 copy displays. And my job was to open those displays and tear the covers off the books, throw all the books away because so we could send the covers back to the publisher to get a return. And I said, look, the Bantam offices are five blocks over. Why don't I just pick up these goddamn books and carry them over and give them back to the guys at Bantam? And he's like, kid, you know, shut up and tear the covers off the books. Anyway.
That's waste. That's terrible. Desecration.
It's terrible waste, right? Terrible. But it's not the way the process worked. But in doing that, in across all the business, I threw myself into learning all the aspects of the business as much as I could. And as it turned out, I was pretty good at managing people. So I got up high very quickly.
So, okay, what's your best lesson or that you can teach us about managing people? What's that one?
What I used to tell people who reported to me directly is, you know, you got to tell me how I can help and how I can change to be better at managing you, right? Because at the end of the day, there's guys who manage people and they say, this is the way I manage. This is what I want of you. This is how it's going to work. And they make the people who work for them conform to what they see as the right way. And my strategy was always to understand what the people needed, each of them as individuals, to be their most effective, the most effective they could be. My job was to make each person as effective as they could be. And then rolled up, make the whole organization as effective as they could be. So what you needed to manage people was to understand as a person, you need to understand what would make them better at their job. Simple as that. And with some people, you know, The answer was never say a critical word to them ever. Always find right, a positive right, way right. to say it. And there's other people who you have to pick up a 2x4 and hit them in the forehead with it to make them understand they have to stop. And the key was each person needs to be motivated. You're better at work if you're motivated, and you're better at work if you're happy at work. And
well, I was going to say,
and yeah. you're having fun. I had the four goals of the organization always, which was to grow faster than the competition. It started as three. It ended up being four. Grow faster than the competition, make a good return for our owner, and goal number three, have fun while doing number one and number two.
Right.
Because
right.
it's a creative business. If you're having fun, you will be better at your job. So part of my role was to make sure each individual in the company could maximize their ability to have fun. And then later probably 13 years ago, I added the fourth goal, which is do less harm to the earth.
That's good.
Those never changed every year.
Yeah, that's very good. Well, it's like you're paying attention to them. You're listening to them. You're trying to make their life happier.
There's a great.
Sorry, but you have to also understand or figure out that, you know, they have to love what they're doing, ideally. So, you know, if someone is kind of a pain in the ass to manage, maybe they're doing the wrong thing with their life.
Exactly right. And the great value is to not ignore that and push that away, which so many people do, but to go tell them that just straight to their face.
Right.
Right. And that's the, you know, honesty, trust. I always told people, you know, when I was trying to coach them to be better managers, you have to be trusted. And the day that you lie to somebody is the day they no longer trust you and they never trust you again. So yeah. be honest, even if it's painful as hell for them right. and for you, be honest. Don't ever not be honest.
It's too bad our politicians aren't listening.
Yeah, no kidding, huh?
Okay, so next question. What have you learned? What have you learned about publishing? How's that?
Okay. Nigel, settle in. You'll put your lunch and dinner on because settle in.
Well, okay, let's go with the top whatever. So let's go with three or four then.
it's all actually pretty simple. Authors and employees in publishing houses basically are serving two different functions, but doing the same thing, right? Taking a book that didn't exist before, the author writes it and the publisher gets it out in the world and gets people to read it, right? So that's the exercise. And in both sides is the same thing. They will, if you believe in what you're doing, in your core, if you believe that this is great stuff, right? And important work, the way to be better at it is all about both sides of that equation. It's all people. And the way to be better at it, it's not management of efficiency. It's instead management of people, right? If the authors feel embraced and their publisher has confidence in them and belief in them, they will be better for that. And if publishers believe that what they're doing is important work and is of great benefit, they'll be better at that. And if they are appreciated, right? If they are appreciated, that's really important, right? More important in publishing than many other aspects. They have to believe that management and the corporation they work for believes in them. And then you have a better publishing company.
Okay. And so how do you show that?
You don't have to show it. If you believe it.
No, but you said they have to believe that they're appreciated. So what makes them think or believe that they're appreciated?
If they are. It's that simple. Think of yourself.
That means what? Yourself. Hey, no, think wait a minute. No, wait, that means you coming up to them and saying, Hey, I appreciate the work you do here.
Yeah, it means that, right? But if you say that, like you just said it to me, they don't believe that.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. I want to know.
If you actually appreciate them all day, every day, your actions will tell them that. You won't even need to say it because your actions will say it.
They will what it is, okay, you're going to get a piece of the action. So, you know, as long as you're making enough money, then there's on top of that, there's we think you are the cat's ass. Like people like to know that.
Yeah, and you have to tell them that, right? But you have to sincerely believe it, because if you just tell them that, they see through that pretty quick.
No, because, and then they say
publishing is full of people who are really goddamn smart, right?
Well, it is, and it's also full of people who are really underpaid.
Yeah, exactly right. Underpaid and smart, and so how do you appreciate them if you're not giving them a huge goddamn paycheck? Because that's the yardstick that shows, generally speaking, that you appreciate them in business, right?
Right.
But
right.
In a way, publishing is sort of a cause combined with a business, right? So
yep.
People have to believe, since the paycheck you're giving them, it's a small margin business. The paycheck you're giving them is a small paycheck. Why are they going to work? Why are they enthusiastic? Why are they having fun? Because all together, you're in this thing. Look at, go into a bookstore, go into an independent bookstore. Look at what they pay the people who work in those bookstores. I mean, they get paid nothing. Look at the actual job satisfaction. Pretty good, right? It's because they believe in what they're doing all day.
Yeah, and just not to belabor the point, but I mean, the best times I've ever had and the stuff that's worked the best for me in my business career was that I was sharing it with someone that I really liked and respected.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, hey, I just landed this big contract. That's fine. I feel good about that because I make money off it. But hey, I want to tell someone.
Yeah. To me, what I learned about publishing is that sharing your enthusiasm for what you do is what makes the place special, right? You should love what you do if you can all day long, right?
But then it's not work, right? Then
right? You should, if you love what you do, and can you create an environment in a publishing house where people love what they do, feel supported in what they do, and feel appreciated for what they do, and where the environment isn't politically charged, internal, look at that guy, but try to make it as much as possible even, fair, and people respecting each other. And then you can create a little magic every once in a while.
That'd be good if the leaders of our countries did something like that.
Those folks got complicated jobs these days, right? Holy cow.
That's true. Yeah. Okay, just sort of slowly winding down here. You sort of touched on it, but what advice do you have? Like, there's a big difference between when you went into publishing and today, obviously. So what advice do you have for today's young, ambitious publishing wannabe?
I would tell you, I don't think it's changed in that regard. I don't think it's changed at all. There's a lot that's changed, a ton that's changed. But how to succeed in publishing, I don't think has changed that much, right? Because how to succeed in publishing is still, you know, you guys still have the same problem. Publishers are publishing thousands of books every year. Each book needs a ton of individual work on it. There is more work, a never-ending flow of more work. And a generalist at the end of the day can be of huge value in a company, as opposed to someone who specializes in only one thing. So I used to speak at the publishing courses and stuff like that a lot. You know, I used to meet with all our interns and all the new employees. I try to give advice to young people about, you know, you're coming to work in the company. You want to succeed here. You have high ambitions. Let me help you and tell you what you need to do that. And it's the same stuff that I learned coming in, which is learn how all the bits of the business work, not just your little thing. Learn all the people you are working with your first years in publishing. They will be in publishing. They will go work at other publishing houses. Some of them will be your boss one day. Some of them may work for you one day. But it's all about the people. Get to know the people. If you're an editor, don't sit and just hang out with all the editorial assistants in the editorial. Go find somebody you like in the sales department and go to lunch with them. And go hang out in the marketing department. And, you know, when the goddamn business guy comes in and says, you haven't filled out your T&E, instead of saying, yeah, you're a pain in my ass, say, hey, is this any fun for you going around bothering people about their T&E? Try to understand what they're going through. Try to understand about their piece of the business, what they contribute, and respect what they contribute. And if you do that, you'll gain information that can make you incredibly effective in the organization, because it's not just about you and what you do. It's a team sport. Publishing is a team sport, 100% a team sport.
Well, that's what makes it so fascinating, is that there's so many different aspects to it. So you want to get out of your silo.
Yeah, get out of your silo. That's exactly good. Really good language. Right? So get out of your silo. Don't come to work just, and you love your silo, right? You look at some of these young editorial assistants are brilliant. And what they really want to do is just discover the next Gone with the Wind. You know, that's what they want to do, out of the slush pile. And, you know, fair enough. But if you're ambitious, now, if all you want to be is a senior editor and that's your career goal, good. Have at it. Bury yourself in it. If you want to be a senior manager in a publishing company, there's a better way.
Yeah, it's kind of like you have to, it's obvious that you do, and you just have to love every aspect of the book, you know?
If you want to be in general management and if you want to understand everything, there's a lot to learn. Find a career path that you are on the steep part of the learning curve all the time until you get to be senior, right? Doing stuff you don't know how to do that you have to learn how to do, and find the bosses in the organization who will let you do that. You know, you want to work for the person who will allow you to make your own decisions. And this is completely counterintuitive to today's people coming into publishing. I mean, they want to be told what to do, and they want to be told what their career path is, and they want specifically outlined, here's what will happen. You'll come in for 2 years, you'll do this. Another year, you'll do that. Then you can be promoted to here. Here's the salaries you'll make at each level. And incidentally, we'll give you guidance so you can feel secure in your job at every step along the way. And I tell them, I said, Matt, what you want is that boss that just gives you a big thorny ass problem and says, go fix it. That's what you want.
You want problems fixed, because once you fix them, you feel happy.
Yeah, and you've learned a lot, right? Whereas if your boss says, go fix this problem and here's how you do it, you start by doing that. Then you do this, then you do this, then you do this. It's like you're not learning. You're memorizing, but you're not learning.
Okay. Now, I just want to shift gears a little bit here. You know, there's all sorts of talk about the threat that other forms of entertainment pose. But I just want to get this on the record here. You can't replicate or duplicate or improve on the experience of reading a book and putting a movie in your own head yourself.
I don't know if you can improve on it or not. It's a different experience, right? That's the beauty of it.
Right. It's not replicable elsewhere.
Yeah. It is non-passive. You have to put energy in. You can't just absorb. You have to put energy in. It's non-passive. Yeah. I've been around long enough that TV was going to knock the book out. The great worries in the early days of how TV was growing and growing and growing and, you know, my God, people aren't going to read. But if you look at today, people read more than they ever have before and continue to. I never was a believer in, you know, oh my God, video games are going to knock us out. And then the internet is going to knock us out because people are going to be just doing Instagram and all that stuff. I never believed that, because reading is a unique thing, and it's a powerful thing.
Now, it's about 30 years ago that I went through this phase where I was reading the Russians.
Yeah.
I love parts of Gladiator, and I love Barry Lyndon. It's another wonderful movie. But it's not that same incredible level of absorption. It's not.
I've never wanted to be a judge of what's a better entertainment, you know? But one thing I know is that the reading thing is different. And I personally, it's my favorite form of entertainment and getting knowledge into your head. But I know that a lot of other people, reading isn't their favorite. But the important thing and the thing that makes it so defensible and always such a good business is it's different and can't be replicated. What it does cannot be replicated. A movie is essentially not much different from watching TV, which is not much different from watching videos on YouTube. But reading is different from all of those and always will be.
That's fascinating, isn't it, really, when you think of it? Just looking at these little marks on the page, and it just gives you some incredible experience. It's hard to believe, but it does.
It's like it's like miraculous, right? The ability for certain humans to take this limited number of words that we use, that's the English language or the French language or the German language, Russian language, take this limited number of words and have the ability to draw from other people's brains an emotional reaction and an actual sort of a movie. And in each person's brain, the movie is different. The experience is the reader and the writer together, right? And the craft of taking these limited number of words, I mean, there's a lot of them, but there is a limit to them, the number of words. And by screwing around with the order to actually tell the stories and to dig in and create the emotive response. And I mean, it's fantastic. If you think of it as a skill and as a passion, it's fantastic. The author role is extraordinary.
It's being creative on the part of the reader too, isn't it?
Of course. This is why when you see novels, you never see a picture of a person on the cover. Think about it.
You do, but
no, only on movie tie-ins.
Only movie tie-in, yeah.
Or the back of their heads.
Yeah, they do a lot
but
of that.
Almost never, I mean, there's rare cases where you do, but you almost never see a face.
Right.
If you think of it, seeing a face, it's all about, you'll see an author's face in nonfiction, but in fiction, each person will think Jack Reacher looks different to every single person because they create what he looks like in their mind. That's why you don't want to put him on the cover.
It's like when they do a movie adaptation, often it's like, oh, fuck it. There's no way he looks like that.
Exactly. Exactly, right? Wow.
You know, it's funny. You know, one thing that really pissed me off was when I was, you know, younger, I read the Frederick Forsyth.
Oh, yeah. They were fantastic.
They were. And I read the Odessa File.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he drove a Jaguar in that, but the movie was an old Mercedes.
Yeah.
I almost walked out of the movie at that point.
Yeah, it's like you create, when you read the book, you create the image of who that person is. That's why people like to write their autobiographies, because they then get to draw your perception of who they are.
Well, they give their version of history is what they do.
And they want you to see them like they want to be seen.
That's right. Yeah. And that's why many autobiographies have varying degrees of bullshit in them.
They all do. I mean, it's a natural tendency. If you're going to sit down and write the story of your life, you're going to put in the good parts, and you're not going to put in, you know, well, I was a complete shit to my children. Who's going to write that?
Well, you know, again, getting back to politicians, it's half-truths is what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, winding down here. Now the real money is at Netflix. So I wonder if they're siphoning off some of the best brains so that we're actually not getting the great novels that we could. If the real money was in books, we would get everyone trying to write the great novel. What do you think about that?
I don't think you have to worry about that at all. Nigel, because if you look at the way that world works, look at what Netflix, where does Netflix go to find their next series?
They frequently go to books, of course. Yes. Yeah. What I'm saying, though, is that instead of writing those books, the young ones, they're going to go straight to Netflix and on the screenplays with Netflix directly.
The smart ones will realize if you want the big Netflix money, write a book that can be adopted to a screenplay.
That's true.
And then you get money both ways, and you get in the easy way in as opposed to the hard way in.
Yeah, okay.
I don't worry about that. And I don't worry about that because people who love to write and want to make money writing, ambitious people, will explore all the avenues.
Well, it's just one of the tools, isn't it, that are available to writers now that maybe didn't used to be available in the past.
And they're writers, you know, there's writers who will really want to write screenplays because just like there's writers who will really want to write literary books and there's writers who will want to write poetry. The screenplay is where they feel most comfortable being creative.
Right.
God bless them. They go that way. And if we didn't have screenplays at all, might there be more people trying to write novels? Sure. But I got to tell you, there's no paucity of people who want to write books.
In fact, that's why there's been such a wonderful explosion in self-publishing. It's allowing all sorts of people who got rejected by the gatekeepers. To get out and I mean, maybe they only do 500 or 1,000 of them, but you can put something really nice out for that and not a lot of money.
And we've seen over and over again how, because it is a subjective decision made by individual people, whether you get published or not, we've seen over and over again, people who were rejected everywhere finally get accepted somewhere, and they have these monster hits, right? Monster hits. And you say, how could 8 editors in New York have rejected that manuscript, right?
Well, a lot of them are self-publishing to start with, aren't they? I mean, look at 50 Shades, wasn't that?
Now you have this other avenue, and it's great, right? It's made it a much more democratic process, and people can actually get it done themselves, and they can get by the gatekeepers. As a historic long-term gatekeeper, you could get by the publisher, and this is fantastic. It's a whole new stream of a way to filter out the stuff that's the weakest and reward the stuff that's strongest. And it's incredibly democratic.
Well, and the other thing that's great is that people are creating. They're creating stuff. The more people that are actually creating stuff, I think it's just the better for society as a whole.
Yeah. And keep creating. And also the ability to bring your work to market evens the playing field in a lot of ways. If you look across, you know, all the sort of judgmental calls we have made over the years, call it on race or call it on creative thought, call it on taking risks with something new. Across the board, there's a tendency for people to do what they're used to and what they're familiar with.
Well, what they think will make the money. It's made the money in the past, it'll do in the future.
If what you have is a whole bunch of white men working in publishing is what it used to, you know, back in the day, then what got published was put through that filter. What the self-publishing and the small publishing can do is it allows everybody a gateway. And then if publishers are on their game, they take the best of that and they pour gas on the fire, right? They find those talents out there that have come up in a sort of democratic, non-gatekeeper environment. They find them, and then they say, oh, now there's a great one. I understand that. And then they pour gas on the fire. They give them a publishing contract, and Shades of Gray happens, right?
Yeah, if that's what the author wants.
Yeah, and then sometimes the author says, I don't need you guys.
Let's just wind up finally for real here.
Okay.
I just wanted to address hyperbole. Every book is the greatest book that's ever been written, if you believe all the blurbs. I'm on the receiving end of all sorts of news releases that come in for all sorts of books, and all the greatest, the most compelling, the most...
greatest ever written, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like so much of it is just pure bullshit.
Yeah. What's the question? What do we do about that, or...
Yeah, what do you do about that?
This is why you need the publishing function at the end of the day, right? And when I say the publishing function, I mean someone to separate.
Yeah, but it's coming from the publishers.
Yeah, yeah. So it comes in these different levels, right? So your first level is hyperbole about the book. And that comes from the author who sends the publisher a note saying, this is the greatest book ever written. Please publish me, right? So it starts there. The publisher then takes that, puts their own hyperbole on top. Here's quotes from four other authors saying this is the greatest book ever written. We're telling you it's the greatest book ever written. Now you got to read it. Now what you need is the next person to tell you what's real and what's not. And that, think of the value of something like Goodreads, right? Which is, hey, it may sort of just make mass appeal the most important thing, but you can look at reviews now and you can discover what a whole bunch of people thought about that book. Now, it may not be important how many people reviewed it. You don't need to look at the Goodreads that has a million reviews, but if you have 18 reviews, all of which gave it 5 stars, and you read 2 of them and you say, wait a minute, that's a book I want to read. So it's separating the noise. A way to say it is a signal from the noise, right? Hyperbole is noise. It's coming at you. It's coming at you. Buried in the hyperbole is a signal of value to you. And the key is, how do you get your signal? You have to find trusted sources to cut through the hyperbole. And you need someone to say, that's noise, this is signal. And that's historically been the job of the reviewers.
That's why I'm talking to James Wood next month.
Yeah, and that's always been valuable, right? That's always, I think in the old days, books got sold out of the reviews. You got a good review in the New York Times, you get hit the bestseller list. Not as much these days, because now there's so much noise and also so many signals buried in that noise.
Yeah.
And the problem with the hyperbole, if you use it, I always tell people, don't ever tell me this is the greatest book ever. You know,
that's right.
Tell me what's good and bad about the book. But this, you know, there was one author whose name I won't share, but every book he published, every book, it went from various publishers. So we had 3 different publishers who published. Published one international, every book, this is unique. This is the most accessible book, literary author. This is the most accessible book he's ever written. I've heard that on every novel we published in this guy. And none of them were more accessible. None of them sold any better.
Right. Now, you say that publishing's job is to facilitate the free flow of ideas. And it's to tell both sides or a variety of sides of the story. Based on the way the United States and Canada and the English-speaking world that I'm familiar with, at least, publishing is failing in that job.
Yeah. And it is sad.
Well, talk about silos.
And what's happening is the employee base in publishing is, you know, they're all New York Senate. All the big firms are in New York. You know, there's some smaller ones in Boston, smaller ones in San Francisco and stuff, but the majority of the business in New York and the people who work there generally come from really good schools and are college educated, and most of them have a liberal outlook. And so there is a new movement that very much says we shouldn't be giving a microphone to anybody who disagrees with our point of view in the world. And our point of view in today's society is a 50-50 split, right? So if we're only publishing books that people we agree with their point of view, if we're only doing that, and if we're not going to publish someone because we don't like something they've done, we're going to cut out 50% of the population of America. And that's terrible, right? So I always said, we should be publishing books that make us feel really uncomfortable. We should be publishing books we hate to publish.
But you know what we need to do is we need to get one side reading the other side's books. That's the challenge.
That's it.
But it's not happening. I mean, how do you do that?
Well, I had a case of that that was interesting, which was under a lot of pressure. We published Bill O'Reilly, and the employee base really wanted us to stop publishing Bill O'Reilly, period.
Who
and
did?
All the employees and agents and all, everybody said, stop, stop, stop. And we published a book called, interesting, he did this series of killing books, right? It was about killing, it started with killing Lincoln and then killing.
Yeah.
And then we did a book called Killing the SS, which is a history about the Nazi hunters post-World War II.
Okay.
And what was really interesting is Bill is a firm believer in never forget. So you might expect Bill O'Reilly to be one of these guys who said, oh, you know, forget that nonsense. We did the right thing. He took the United States government to task in his book for helping former Nazis escape. The heroes of the book were the Israelis, Simon Wiesenthal, the Israelis who tracked these guys down and brought them to justice were the heroes. So when people said we shouldn't publish Bill O'Reilly, I would say, listen, 600,000 people are going to read that book. And they are Bill O'Reilly fans. Aren't those exactly the people you want to read this book? Because those are the people who will really might learn something because their natural tendency will not be in that direction. Bill O'Reilly's fans might not be in their nature, never forget people. The great value is to find a thinker who is politically on one side of the equation, who will engage in intelligent discourse about the other side, not those guys are the devil, screw them.
Yeah, not a polemic against the other side. What you want is a rational, intelligent conversation.
It goes right back to what we were saying in the beginning, right? The right way to have this conversation is to put yourself in the shoes of the guy on the other side. So instead of saying that guy is an idiot because he believes that we should build a wall, right? Okay. Maybe he works in a town where he couldn't get a job. And he couldn't get a job because a government program had come in and given a whole bunch of jobs to immigrants.
Yep.
Put yourself in his shoes. Now look at the situation. Now, can you see why that guy cheers when Trump says, build the wall? Yeah, you can see why he's cheering. That's what you have to do. Take that first step. Try to understand, not to castigate, not to say that guy's a jerk. Instead, put yourself in his shoes and try to understand why he might be feeling this way. And then have the conversation. But do that first.
Yeah. And what you want to publish are books that facilitate that kind of...
That's it. Learn how the other side sees it. Don't bury yourself only. If you're a liberal, don't watch just MSNBC. Try to understand what the other side's point of view is, as opposed to just saying they're wrong and they're stupid. Because that's what we're doing in America today. We're telling them they're wrong and they're stupid. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And they're not, you know?
That's why publishing is more important than ever then.
Yeah. And this is one of the things that I have a unique gift. I got a unique gift is that growing up on a ranch in Wyoming, that state votes more Trump than anyone else. I know why they're voting for Trump, right? And I can understand it.
Okay, so that's going to go into this book that you're just about to publish?
No, hell no. Nobody wants to read that shit. What they want to read about is, you know.
No, you got to put it in some stories that we can understand. The other side.
You sound just like fucking Gillespie here. He should keep saying, you got to put yourself in the book. I said, nobody wants to hear about that shit. They want to hear a good story. People want to hear a good story. Nigel, you'll be the judge. If when I get it done in some form, even if I'm self-publishing it or just giving it to my kids and have it printed up 500 copies, I'll send you one and you can tell me how I did.
I appreciate that. Okay. And just to tie it up here, when you were hired by Dieter Holzbrink, he said to you that it's important that we publish great books.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what your great-grandfather said.
Yeah.
And what I'd like to say is that it's important that I interview great interviewees, and you've been one. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much. Real pleasure.
I've been speaking to John Sargent, who is the, how do you want to sign yourself off?
Former CEO of Macmillan.
Very good.
And hopefully all around good guy.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, man. Take care.
Okay, you too.